Hello. I was cut off as I was finishing up Chapter 5, Might is Right by Ragnar Redbeard. So let me go on. There's about 8 or 9 more pages to finish it up. I'm not going to make a whole new recording. Maybe we'll stitch them together, but this will be part 3 of it. And he was just gone through a peon de force. And let's resume where we were. I was trying to pause it because there was truck noise, but it's now stopped, so a bit of a lag in my computer somehow turned it off by itself. So, after naming all the things that Force does, he says, "Even the music of the spheres is the vibrant roar of warring elements, chanting the gloria of power. If Force is the all-in-all of the planetary systems and of the animal world, may it not also be the open sesame of sociology? The primeval principle that governs and must continue to govern the relations of tribe to tribe and man to man. Is it not the gospel of antiquity as well as the logical reductio of today? Whether in mortgaged republics, pawn monarchies, or hypothecated despotisms, the sword power, that is to say the military power, the clubbing power, is the ultimate ipse dixit, because I said so, in the measuring out of right and wrong. As it was in the days of the fierce Sesostris, the devastating Genghis, the venturesome Charlemagne, so is it even now. In all industrial relations, might is monarch of all it surveys. Authority is authority, though it might take on 1,000 diverse forms. What is the elemental difference between a Roman mandamus, a Turkish firman, a Russian ukase, a Supreme Court injunction, or an order in chancery? They are exact synonyms. Whatever their salient phraseology may be, in operation they are visible manifestations of the imperial power of sceptered majesty. No sacerdotal sophistry, priestly lies, can permanently disguise this fact, and what is more important, no emotional demagoguery can remove it. Authority is not an evil in itself. It is as natural for men of power to rule feeble multitudes as it is for the lion to eat the lamb. When any nation or class of men possess no real might, it is just and proper that they should be subordinated. And again, if they develop the requisite strength, it is equally justifiable for them to reconquer their former position and subordinate their subordinators. Evolution works through authority, but there is to it no limitation, so nothing is ever fixed forever. The penalty of defeat is tremendous. Wage earning is, in modern times, the main clause in the treaty under which the defeated are permitted to exist. Even-handed justice has never existed in the animate creation and never can. The very idea of it is an absurdity. Evolution knows it not. Between beasts of burden and beasts of prey, also between capital and labor, there is an eternal combat. Natural enemies are they of each other, and whichever proves the stronger must rule, for the time being, or rather until the next test. The law of battle is unlimited. It does not end today or tomorrow. It persists for all time. Between the optimates and the populares of Rome, the aristos and helots of Greece, the aristocrats and slaves, helot means slave in Greece, the merchant kings and Nubian serfs of Carthage, the military caste and the slaves of Karnak and Memphis, those are Egyptian towns, the same irrepressible conflict raged for long centuries that is now being waged everywhere, in italics, between the haves and the have-nots. Indeed, the agrarian agitation, that was a big thing in the 1850-1900 period, and the tumultuous strife between the debtor and the creditor classes of what happened in the Greco-Roman world. Modern leaders, however, on both sides are poor, miserable weaklings compared with the chiefs of antiquity. Mere infants are they, delighting in toys and lullabies, seeing they see not, hearing they hear not, minds have they, but they know not, laughing and prattling they say not, most eloquently. To them, their petty provincial cradle is the universe, and their lives an aimless wandering in the land o' dreams. The men who talk of permanently reconciling conflicting worldwide energies are wasting their breath for naught. Compromise is out of the question, now as of old, except as a temporary expedient. The rich and the poor are both inevitable natural products and complements of each other, like the opposing currents in an electric battery. It is the business of the rich to exploit the poor, and it is equally the business of the poor to defeat and exploit in their turn. The oppression of one class by another is always induced by the physical cowardice of the victimized. Boy, there is a lesson for the whites to learn. And nature has no love for dastards, whether rich or poor. Oppression is one of the necessary phases of evolution. In order, therefore, to ensure the subordination and ultimate annihilation of the lower type, the struggle for survival is imposed upon humans as upon all other animals. Even when our eminent wiselings are predicting eras of universal peace and contentment, the contending cohorts are preparing to jump at each other's throats, as of yore. Might must, as it has decided all things in the past, and they who teach otherwise are either dishonest or have no real conception of the magnitude and sequence of biological determinants. All the world is now in debt, and alone the principal, in cash. Business lives under a cloud of mortgage indebtedness that must someday be liquidated with shot and shell, for bonds infer bondage. All realized wealth is transfigured force, and want of it a sure sign of sterility and degeneracy. Industrialism is the manipulation of force by force. Brains and muscles are part of the mechanism of gravitation. Descendants of prisoners of war have been trained for ages in servitude, and they make most intelligent mechanics, specialists, and serving men. Capital is concentrated in force, applied to the extraction and storage of additional force. It may be operated by its proprietor in any way that he pleases. He is under no obligation to others as to its application or proprietorship. He can do as he likes with his own, as long as he has the power. He may own the earth by its agency if he wants to, and he may buy or sell men and nations if he feels so inclined or thinks it profitable. There is in nature no limit to his energies or ambitions. All that is needed is power equal to the design. But the same principles may be acted upon by any other man or association of men, and in the conflict that ensues, fitness is proved absolutely and without a doubt. So these forces doing battle basically defines not only the natural world, but all men and political and social world, and the world the Christians are trying to say is not made of animals and then material, but is spiritual and is in between angels and animals. He's saying that it's all subject to the same rules of force and competing forces, proving their fitness by defeating each other by whichever means works. But no victory is permanent. The rights of the rich are what they can maintain, and the rights of the poor are no less. No bounds are set in the accumulation of property, and none whatever to its redistribution. Fair play is not even an essential or a requisite. It may be established, if mutually desired by both combinations, but it may also be wholly dispensed with. In real life, it is always dispensed with by those who possess a preponderance of material might. Equality can only exist among equals. Civilization implies division of labor, and division of labor implies subordination, and subordination implies injustice and inequality. Woe to me if I speak not the truth. At such words as these, pusillanimity blanches with timidity, gathers in its idol hall, supplicating, Lord, have mercy on us. Christ, have mercy on us. Deliver us from evil. In primitive communities, the philosophy of power is thoroughly understood and acted upon by all classes, even by the servi, Latin root word of servant, asservi, S-E-R-V-I, asterisk, asterisk, Latin word of servant, applied indiscriminately to mules, eunuchs, slaves, philosophers, historians, scribes, prisoners of war, and working cattle generally. They were all considered servants, Latin word servi. The ideas of abstract justice, righteousness, non-resistance can find no lodgment in an uncorrupted brain. Life is too grim in a camp of hunters and warriors for artificialism to meet with anything more appreciative than a good-natured sarcasm. He who has to hunt for his family dinner every forenoon and sees land on which to build his shelter is not over likely to enthusiastically swallow the depraved theoria of self-renunciation or pledge unbounded allegiance to a self-appointed ring of tax gatherers masquerading as political philanthropists. He maintains his own independent, inherent royalty as long as he can and never surrenders except before absolutely superior force. Even then, he vows limitless vengeance and obligates his sons and his sons' sons to undying hatred against the domination and spoliation of his conquerors. Section 10. We have about 3-4 more pages here. In evolution, there is no finality. It is operating always in some form, endeavoring to blot out inferior organisms and perpetuate more perfect types. Like the gods of antiquity, it is both a destructive and a creative. The powerful of the past were overthrown by the more powerful of the present, and in strict sequence, the powerful of today must be overthrown by the more powerful of tomorrow. All moral dogmatism and religiosities are positive hindrances to the evolution of the higher manhood, inasmuch as men who honestly grasp at morals do not as energetically grasp at power, power being essentially non-moral. Consequently, the struggle between the propertied and the property-less classes is not as keen as nature evidently intends it to be. The moral man is a feeble antagonist to a non-moral generalship. He foolishly permits talkative personalities with sharper perceptive qualities to wield unlimited authority over him under numerous plausible pretexts and deliberately plunder him of his property. There is far and away too much weepful mea culpa about the average mannequin. And that's another, that's a little man or a false little doll, a little doll of a man. Another way of saying manlet. Hence the woes of the world. Hence the origin of the morbid, that means diseased, sick, craving by dwindlings. Another insult for men. For what they call a peaceful solution of the social problem. Weak natures are terrorized at the idea of what might happen in a death grapple with entrenched adversaries equally as strong, if not stronger than themselves. That is the true reason why rich men are so anxious at all times to avoid discussion and maintain the peace, and why poor men hunger with fatness around them and thirst while the waters flow near, for the law and the gospel hath damned them and dulled their senses with fear. The fact is that both sides are afraid of each other, afraid of the only rational solution. My curse be upon the white-livered and the meek, the shameful dwindlings who call themselves the virtuous, the law-abiding, the righteous, the godly, the obedient ones. May civilization pump its vile narcotism through the flaccid ventricles of their pigeon hearts. May they inhale the brain leprosy through the open windows of their temples of soot, and may their noisome swineries and splendid ergastly be unto them living tombs. May they earn their bread, also that of their conquerors, by the slimy sweat of dishonored brows, and may they perish at last like abandoned curs. May they vegetate in poverty and die in contempt. May the evil works of their genius be plowed under with Babylon and Nineveh, Anuak and Rome. May the annals of their dismal domination become, as the folk tale of a fearsome nightmare that once rolled over the brain of mankind, finally dissipating itself midst thunders and lightnings and the breaking up of the great deep. Verily, verily, let them have their reward. It is customary for atrophied minds like Bluntschli to urge that the promulgation of such grim thoughts endanger the foundations of society. Even supposing that to be so, what is society anyhow that its foundation should not be threatened? Is society something immaculate, something divine, something anointedly ultra-human, something that must be safeguarded, rim and thummim, an ark of the covenant, a sanctum sanctorum, or merely an ass's head hidden behind a veil? Why should the phrase society in danger be equivalent to the proclamation of a rigid taboo or a fanatical crusade? Why? Society is altogether a matter of convenience, an implement, an expediency. It is the creation of man, and what man manufactures, he may modify or destroy. Society may be defined as an agglomeration of carnivorous and herbivorous animals seeking their natural prey and browsing along on whatever nutriment they pick up. It is nothing more than a herd of two-legged cattle, and there is nothing supernaturally divine about a herd. Indeed, the word herd always suggests Gadara. Those are the pigs that Jesus drove off the cliff. The scapegoat, like a scape pig, put the sins of the Jewish community on the pigs and then drive them off a cliff. And that pays for the sins, atones for them. I believe is where Gadara swine. So indeed, the word herd always suggests Gadara, G-A-D-A-R-A. Humans swarmed and disintegrated 10,000 times, 10,000 by centrifugal and centripetal energy of individuals. Remember, he emphasized individual activity versus herd think. Societies have risen and societies have fallen, but man, the unit, the germplasm, persists. Not only the clay, but also the potter, the paramount determinant. His fate is in his own hands, absolutely within the length of his tether. To the strong, all laws are cobwebs, Solon. And when society becomes irksome to the strong, they may dissolve it. Otherwise, it becomes their master and consequently their enemy and oppressor. Society in danger, therefore, is merely the hysteria of the society in some shape must exist as long as there are two human beings left alive, for the companionship is as natural to the homo, the man, as swarming is to the bee. When, however, the word society develops into a synonym for socialistic restraint, then it becomes a menace to the evolution of the type and ought to be broken up accordingly, without overmuch ceremony. Friendship is necessary and ennobling, but impersonal despotism is destructive of all dignity and manly virtue. The real danger is that innocent and natural combinations for mutual pleasure, there's that use again, combinations, comradeship, profit, and defense may transform themselves gradually into organized majority box tyrannies, enslaving institutionalisms of the most dictatorial and obnoxious character. When society is thus transformed into a vast blackmailing operation, the lives and property of its component units are absolutely at its mercy, and it therefore ought to be disintegrated consciously, deliberately, pitilessly, and at whatever cost. One is reminded of Gwyneth Paltrow's and Chris Martin's conscious uncoupling, which is whites going their own way from this society where they aim to use the brown hordes they are illegally bringing into the country to outvote us and steal our property and everything good in this world that we have created for ourselves and our posterity. Freedom cannot be bought too dear, for life without liberty is pandemonium. Government and society are two distinct entities, and care must be taken not to confound them. Society is the growth of mutual tolerance, friendship, and obligation, but government arises from physical force applied by the strong to the control and exploitation of vanquished foes. The sanction of government is the same that holds good throughout the whole zoological and heliocentric scale, the sanction of material might. That sanction should always be under test, because the most abject weakling may brandish a sword, but we do not know he is a weakling until another sword in the grip of a man is pointed at his throat. Beowulf, a Saxon songmaster, apostrophizing the sword, voices this primeval organon as it was instinctively understood by our ancestors. Quote from Beowulf, I guess. The war thing, the comrade, father of honor and giver of kingship, the fame smith. Just as a blacksmith makes iron into things, a sword creates fame. Fame comes from a sword. The war thing, the comrade, the father of honor and giver of kingship, the fame smith, the song master, clear singing, clean slicing, sweet spoken, soft finishing, making death beautiful, life but a coin to be staked in the pastime, whose playing is more than transfer of being. Arch Anarch, chief builder, Arch Anarch, because it kills people and creates new rulers. Arch Anarch, chief builder, prince, and evangelist. It persuades people. It raises and exalts rulers. It undermines them. I am the will of God. I am the sword. That's the Aryan way of looking at things among the Germanic tribes. It is only in ages saturated in atmospheres of brain-wrecking artificialism, in consumptive communities steeped to the very lips in elemental error, that senile, degrading, anthropomorphic myths and manias are substituted for hard, bitter, common sense. All great truths are hard and bitter, but lies to the morbidly inclined, those who prefer disease to health, are sweeter than wild honey. Euphemisms. Soft, nice doctrines. Wouldn't it be nice? Wouldn't you like to believe? Wouldn't you like to believe? No, I only want to believe what's true. And that's the manly way. One by one, we abandon realisms to follow Fata Morganas. That's like a mirage. We are mortgaging our destiny to the pawnbrokers of decadence. Behold, the legerdemain of the Orient demonetized the manhood of the West. They devalued our racial currency by trading us these shit doctrines for real and valuable reality-based realisms. We fight like women and feel as much. The thoughts of our heart we guard. Where scarcely the scorn of a god could touch, the sneer of a fool hits hard. The treacherous tongue and the cowardly pen, the weapons of curs decide. They faced each other and fought like men in the days when the world was wide. And yet the world is beautiful as a blushing maiden dreaming of her first lover. Quote, fair laughs the morn, and soft the breezes blow, and men only await captaining to capture and possess. Take it, it's yours, if you can, says nature, winking at you. And there's a last little coda, sort of, for this chapter. Manhood is demonetized. This little pamphlet has been issued not for private profit, but to assist in uprooting the alien and pernicious, that's dangerous, poisonous, ideals, capital I, that have been for long centuries corrupting the blood and corroding the brain of Europe and America. Conventional moral dogmas and political standards of value are, like wooden idols, the work of men's hands. They have no real basis in nature, nor have they any supernatural sanction. Every one of them has been carved out of a worm-eaten, i.e. a brazen assumption, or a madman's dream. They are impositions most insolent. Why should we bow down, even in formal adulation, before imbecile and unnatural principles invented thousands of years ago for the enslavement of Oriental decadence? Have we not given lip service long enough to false heroisms and fool evangels? Why feign the possession of slave virtues? Why continue to glorify untruths that we know to be untruths? Why should men of sterling worth obey any other man's thou shalt? Let us return to nature for our moral standards. Let us search our own hearts and brains for the true meaning of right and wrong. We are living and dying, mostly dying, in a poisonous environment of deep-seated moral dementia, social disease, and political illusions. The righteous and the just, hypocrites, deceivers, enemies of all that is noble, courageous, and manly, destroyers of self-assertiveness, annihilators of heroism. Would that I had a legion of demons to wring their necks. A crucified Jew slave, terrorized under authority, is set up as a god, as a standard of measurement for all mankind. That is why personal valor and nobility of thought are at such a tremendous discount. Christendom is in bondage. Manhood is demonetized. Our race is betrayed. And that would be the end of chapter 5. So this was the end, effectively, of part 3. I only planned part A and part B, but the machine shut itself. The machine took things into its own hands, perhaps inspired by the words. Spirit of the machine, as Sting might say. Tracy Kidder, was it? The soul of a new machine. That's a good work about. I read many decades ago about sort of the origins of the computer industry and what types devised it. Now, they're often Midwestern men who went out to Palo Alto and the area around Stanford and developed, like, I think that was specifically about Hewlett-Packard, one of the main guys there. Might be wrong. Tracy Kidder, long time ago. Anyway, not to get too far away, but the machine shut down part B, so I made a part C, and now we finish with chapter 5. Thanks for being with me today. This has been Alex Linder talking to you and reading to you from Might is Right by Ragnar Redbeard, published in 1910. Edited by Katya Lane and put up is at vnnforum.com. You're welcome to join, and often permanently archived at alexlinder.com sometime down the road. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll pick up with chapter 6 from Might It Right.